The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of both the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our various programs, please visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from the Blue Cliff Record, case 95. Chang Ching's Three Poisons. The Pointer. Where there is Buddha, do not stay. If you keep staying there, your head will sprout horns. Where there is no Buddha, quickly pass by. If you don't run past, weeds will grow 10 feet high. Even if you're pure and naked, bare and clean, without mental activity outside of things, without things outside of mental activity, you still have not escaped standing by a stump waiting for a rabbit. But tell me, without being like any of this, how would you act? To test, I cite this old case. Chang Ching once said, rather say that saints have the three poisons, but do not say that the Tathagata has two kinds of speech. I do not say the Tathagata is speechless, just that he doesn't have two kinds of speech. Pao Fu said, what is Tathagata speech? Ching said, how could a deaf person hear? Pao Fu said, I knew you were talking on the secondary level. Ching said, what is Tathagata speech? Pao Fu said, go drink some tea. The verse, primary, secondary, a reclining dragon does not look to still water. Where he is, there's the moon, the waves settle. Where he is, waves arise without wind. Oh, Chan Traveler Leng, in the third month at the gate of you, you've got a failing mark. So on Thursday at the Fusatsu, I talked a little bit about right speech, and I don't know quite what happened. I hadn't even gotten halfway through the talk, and we'd run out of time. So I know what happened. I talked too much. It's not that complicated. So I wanted to continue and look at speech and language from within the Dharma. Buddhism has such a, particularly Mahayana Buddhism, has such a profound understanding, I believe, of language and consciousness. And Zen also, I think, has a very, very important and profound understanding and contribution to make within the Dharma realm regarding particularly language. Chang Ching was has kind of an interesting story. He lived during the late 9th, early 10th century China, studied with Zhuai Feng. He practiced for a while and was struggling a lot, had a lot of difficulties and doubts in his practice, and so went to study with Zhuai Feng, who was a very well-known teacher. And Zhuai Feng gave him some practice instruction that Chang Ching practiced diligently for 2.5 years, it says, till late one night he was sitting up after everyone else had gone to bed, and at one point he rolled up a bamboo blind, and his eye caught sight of a lantern, and he had an enlightenment experience. And so the next day he went to Zhuai Feng with an enlightenment verse, which was a way of presenting his understanding. I was so far off, then all the earth was revealed when I rolled up a screen. If anyone asks me to explain our school, I'll raise the whisk and slap their mouth. Zhuai Feng presented that to one of his senior disciples, Zhuangxia. And Zhuangxia said, I don't approve his enlightenment based on this verse. He could have written this based on his ordinary understanding, conscious understanding. We have to test him further. And so that evening, everybody assembled for a mando. And Zhuai Feng said to Chang Ching, your Dharma sibling, Zhuangxia here, doesn't approve yet of your understanding. If you have had a direct insight into the nature of things, please present your understanding now. And so Chang Ching then presented a new verse. Amidst the myriad realms, a solitary body is revealed. Only persons self-allowing are intimate with it. Before, I wrongly searched amongst the paths, but today I see, and it's like ice in fire. And now Zhui Feng looks, his teacher, looks at Zhuangzi and says, I don't accept this now. This too could have been written from his ordinary thinking consciousness. And so then Chang Qing said to his teacher, Zhui Feng, please, master, demonstrate what has been passed down by all the ancestors. And Zhui Feng remained silent. And Chang Qing bowed and walked away. And it says Zhui Feng smiled. And I think this is interesting in relationship to what I wanted to talk about today, the role of language. These two poems that he presents are quite different. Quite different. And how ultimately, and it also raises the question of how does a teacher test the understanding of a student? How do they know at every point along the way, not just their enlightenment, but their practice, their understanding, because the teacher can't get into the mind of the student and sit there with them on the cushion. And language, by its nature, right? We can use language to present worlds that we may or may not have ever visited. And so how does, in the tradition, in any Buddhist tradition, where there is the need for where it's the Buddhist tradition, where people are practicing to practice and realize themselves, how does a teacher help guide the student and help affirm when that student has gained entry? And so in the pointer, Yuanwu says, where there is Buddha, do not stay. If you stay there, your head's going to sprout horns. If there is no Buddha, go run quickly past, otherwise weeds will grow. So in other words, don't go where there is Buddha or no Buddha. Well, what is this pointing to? So the mind grasps at things, right? That should become clear to every practitioner. And it also grasps at no things. It grasps at death. And then as we enter into practice, we can grasp at the idea or the experience of deathlessness. And since all grasping is illusory, because there is no limit to our grasping. I mean, think of that. Because all grasping is illusory. In other words, it's not based in any true reality. There's no limit to it. And isn't that exactly what we see? There seems to be no limit to our grasping, to what we can grasp at, to the subtleties of our grasping. But we see that all grasping must necessarily arise from a sense that there is something, someone who is desiring, there is something that is desired, and there's the belief that that is true. Those two, subject and object, exist. And that if we obtain what we're grasping, we will find some satisfaction. In other words, there's a belief, a view within. So in every grasping, those have to be present, whether we're conscious of them or not. And so what is the implication of all dharmas or forms of emptiness? That all things, inner and outer, material and immaterial, are fundamentally without any self-existing, independent, permanent nature. All dharmas are forms of emptiness is another way of saying that all things are already liberated. They are not bound by anything. Which is another way of saying, a ramification you might say of that, is that when we see it directly, when we come into contact, intimate contact with that, it not only is liberated, but it is liberating. And so practice is coming to that intimate contact. And that from that view, which is Mahayana view of reality, everything then becomes of that very nature. Everything is empty, everything is liberated, and everything is potentially liberating. And so here, and we enter into practice, and what we encounter in the Zen tradition is Zen is a special transmission outside scriptures, outside the most fundamentally important teachings that Buddhism has to offer, the most direct pointings there are. That it is a special transmission somehow outside of that, and that it ultimately doesn't rely on words and letters, although it uses them. And so we enter with that sort of those cautionary words. And so here, Chung Ching says, it's better to say that the enlightened beings have the three poisons, greed, anger, and delusion, than to say that they have two kinds of speech, or that the Buddha has two kinds of speech. Chung Ching says, I don't say the Buddha is speechless, but just that the Buddha doesn't have two kinds of speech. And so Chung Ching studied with Zhui Feng. Pao Fu was another Dharma sibling of Chung Ching. So these are Dharma siblings. They're in the same family. And so they're having a conversation together. And so Pao Fu says, well, what is Tathagata speech? What is Buddha speech? What is enlightened speech? And so in the Fusatsu, I talked about right speech. So the Buddha said that we use speech wrongly, that is, to create suffering, to obscure, to obstruct by speaking deceptively, by speaking harshly, by speaking maliciously, trying to divide through our language, and by speaking in a way that is distracting or numbing, purposeless. And so that would seem to point to deluded speech, right? And then right speech, to speak honestly, to not elevate the self and blame others, to not speak of others' errors and faults, would be more enlightened speech. And so are there two kinds of speech? Is there enlightened speech and deluded speech? And if that's so, where is the delusion? In the words? Is it in the mind? Is it in the one who hears? When we realize that all things have one nature, we realize there's nothing apart from this. There's nothing outside of this. So Chung Ching says, don't say that the Buddha has two kinds of speech, one inside and one outside, one high and one low. But if that's true, then why do words and what they mean, which is empty of any intrinsic characteristic or quality or power, why do some heal and some hurt? Why do some bring us together and some tear us apart? What are words? When Pao Fu says, what is Buddha speech? Chung Ching says, how could a deaf person hear? A deaf person, a blind person, with no ear, eye, nose, tongue, body, mind, who is not sitting with any realm of sight or sound or consciousness, when love and hate, self and other, enlightenment and delusion are absent, the way is clear and undisguised, the faith mind says. How could a deaf person hear? And Pao Fu said, yeah, I knew you were talking on the secondary. And so what does that mean? In the commentary, it says, Pao Fu knew that Chung Ching had been making his living in a ghost cave for some time. A ghost cave is a place that we grasp onto. It is a place where we attached to no thing. to deafness, to blindness, a spiritual deafness and blindness, a spiritual emptiness in which there are not so many concerns. There is no trouble in the world. And so he said, I knew you were speaking on the secondary. That's why the pointer says, where there is no Buddha, don't stay there. Why are there... Let me read something more that'll bring this out a little bit. In the commentary, it says, a reclining dragon doesn't... A dragon, of course, is an enlightened being. A reclining dragon does not look to still water. In dead water, how can a dragon thrive? If it is primary and secondary, then this indeed is making a livelihood in dead, stagnant water. If it's on one side or the other, if it's in the absolute or the relative, if it's in the one or the many, if it's inside or outside, then this is making a livelihood in dead, stagnant water. He says, therefore, there must be huge swells, wide and vast, white waves flooding the sky. Only there can a dragon be fully brought to life. Why are there so many teachings in the Zen tradition and other Buddhist traditions, going back to the Buddha, that are warning us about that dead, stagnant water? You know, when we see a teaching over and over again, we should hear those as warnings. Warning, warning, warning. Alert. Right? You are entering into dangerous territory here. And we're like, what? What could be dangerous? It's said in so many different ways that on the path we enter into that place where there is no Buddha. There is no self. There is no eye or ear or nose. There is no one who can see, who can think, who can be worried, who can be afraid, who can be angry. And it is not a place of control. It is a place of relinquishing our control. It is by its very nature not a created state. And so we can imagine wanting to stay there a while. And so these constant warnings and admonitions to be alert. The dragon will die there, will have no life. There will be no bodhisattva. There is no bodhisattva in that still, quiet, calm water, sweet and beautiful though it may appear. And so he says, when there is no Buddha. So first we have to deal with the idea of Buddha and not stay there. Then realizing where there is no Buddha, we continue to move past that. And this is not just poetic language. It's really a matter of our living and dying. Of dying within life so we can live. Of living within death so we can die. And so, what is Buddha speech? Chang-Ching asks, and Pao Fu says, go drink tea. To rouse the dragon from its stagnant waters. So in the Ten Directions fascicle by Master Dogen, Dogen says, he quotes Master Changsha, who said, the entire world of the Ten Directions is the everyday words of a student of the way. Now again, remember that Buddhism points over and over and over again to how words and language and their meaning is where we get trapped, right? Because words objectify, they point to. They create a sense of something. And once we look at something and we can name it and we can describe it, we pretty much think we've got it. We know it. And that's where we die. That water becomes dead. Right? What else is there? And what it's done is it's put us at a distance. And here Dogen is saying the entire world of the Ten Directions, what what in the commentary is huge swells, wide and vast, white waves flooding the sky, this image of limitless vastness, spaciousness. The world of the Ten Directions is the everyday words of a student of the way. Everyday, Dogen says, means ordinary. As a colloquial expression in Japan, we say common, common words. Thus, a student's common words are the entire world of the Ten Directions. The words and speech are straightforward, as everyday words are the entire world of the Ten Directions. Investigate clearly that the entire world of the Ten Directions is everyday words. So even those words that we can use to deceive, to divide, to hurt, to distract, they themselves are the entire world of the Ten Directions, and they are being used in a way that is not skillful. Dogen says words are straightforward, ordinary, everyday things, and they are the entire world of the Ten Directions. Don't say there are two kinds of speech. In the Lankavatara Sutra, which is a very important sutra in the Zen tradition, the Mahayana tradition, it's important in Tibetan Buddhism as well, and is very much based in kind of teaching out of the Yogacara teachings. The Bodhisattva Mahamati asked the Buddha about words and language, and the Buddha says, how is speech produced? Depending on discrimination and habit energy as the cause, that is, our karma. So when we speak, we're speaking our karma. He says, out of this, there is the conjunction and distinction of sounds and letters, which issue from the teeth and jaws and palate and tongues and lips and the cavity of the mouth. He's very detailed about this. We make mutual conversations possible. This is what we call speaking. Now, what is meaning? And I don't know what the original language is here, what the translation is. Meaning is a little confusing because I don't think he's talking about the ordinary sense we have of the meaning of words, which is more words. Right? When you go to Bill Waldron says, when you go to a dictionary to see find out the definition of a word, you encounter more words, right? And sometimes you have to look up those words, right? I don't think he's talking about meaning in that way. I think he's talking about the underlying nature of things. So what is the underlying nature of speech? And the Buddha says, when the Bodhisattva is said to have grasped that fundamental nature, it is when they have gone all alone into a lonely path and walked that path leading to nirvana, to liberation. And by means of their transcendental wisdom, which is present within each of us, and which grows from hearing the Dharma, reflecting, and meditating, it brings around a revulsion, first at the source of our habit energy, by our self-knowledge. That is, as we become more and more aware, there's a revulsion, or the Buddha, we might say, a disenchantment at the source of a habit energy. In other words, we begin to see more and more into the arising of our language, our words, where they come from, the effect of them on ourselves and others, and we have a revulsion. We begin to become disenchanted. We realize, oh, wait a minute. This is not just nothing. This is actually extremely powerful, and it's having a profoundly powerful effect on each of us in every moment that we spend talking to ourselves. And particularly talking to ourselves in a way that is not mindful and is not right speech. And then he says the Bodhisattva goes on to observe that words are neither different nor not different from their fundamental nature. That their fundamental nature is neither different nor not different from words. Form is emptiness and emptiness is form. Absolute and relative are like two arrows meeting in midair. He says, but if a person becomes attached to the words and their ordinary meaning and we hold fast to that, then we will come to cherish our views that will arise in either affirmation or negation. And as varieties of objects of the world are seen and discriminated, we will make statements erroneously. We will talk. We will make language. We will speak. We will have views, which is forming language. We will express those views in our language. We will have those conversations with ourselves, and we will have them with others. We will write books in which we will put those views. We will create websites in which we will have those views. We will become presidents of countries, and those views and those words will go around the world and have impact. And yet we use those words so casually. I came across a letter a month or so ago. I was going through some old folders, and I came across a letter by a fellow that I'd met in one of our prison sanghas. Upstate, I used to go to prison in the southern Adirondack, so it was far away, so I could only go a few times a year. And I'd spend a part of the day there because I couldn't go there that much. And there was a fellow there named Petros, and I'm giving his name because I'm going to draw from an article that was published, so I don't think he would mind at all my using his name. And Petros, if by any chance you should hear this talk, I hope you're doing well, give me a call. I did hear from him, actually, after he got out of prison, and he was doing quite well. But he wrote this really excellent piece that I thought sort of brought this out in a very nice way. And as I draw from this, think about the power of language, because he speaks about it, but it's an example of the power of language in terms of how it can be used as sickness and as medicine, how it can be used in awareness and a lack of awareness, how it can bring peace and how it can bring war, all within the simple few words that he speaks. So in the context of this article that he wrote, he said, "When I speak with people, especially when I meet new people, I catch myself trying to project a likable image. Sometimes I stop before I speak. Sometimes I become aware while I'm in the middle of speaking. And at other times, after I've already finished. Sometimes I'm even aware even before I start, but I still go ahead with it. And when I catch myself doing this, I have a talk with myself, especially when I meditate later that day. I ask myself questions." So notice how every moment that he's talking about, where he's talking out of a kind of habit energy, where he becomes aware of that habit energy at the beginning, in the middle, or after the end, after it's over, and then he goes to his cushion and he brings questions, that at every point along the way, he's talking. He's speaking, right? He's using words that have power. And he's using those words in different ways and affecting different actions or consequences by the different use of that power. Where is that power? And so he asks himself questions like, why do I feel it's necessary to present this image? Why do I need to be liked or accepted? Why do I want the attention of others? Why do I need their approval? Am I afraid that if I don't do this, people won't like me or want to hang out with me, and I'll feel alone? Am I afraid of being alone? Am I afraid that if others don't like me, I won't like myself either? I see that when others praise me for something, I like myself more. Why does my happiness depend on how other people see or treat me? Excellent questions. He says, the most important question that I ask is, who is it that wants to be perceived this way or that wants to be treated well by others? After all, the characteristics that I'd like to show people about myself are just ideas and concepts. They're not real. I think that they're not real because the image changes over time. Characteristics are added, they're taken away. If they were the real thing, they would be with me for life. They'd be permanent. If the characteristics are not real, then what is real? Then he says, projecting and trying to maintain a self-image can bring a lot of trouble. Then he tells a story about how a couple of years ago, a friend of his had to go to court at Rikers Island, and he had a radio that was the loudest radio they allowed you to have, which they had since then discontinued the use of. So his friend still had this radio, and because it was no longer allowed, it was highly valued. It became more valuable. And so he thought, what am I going to do with this important, valuable thing while I'm out of the prison? And so another friend of his said, I'll keep it for you. And he said, okay, take good care of it. And then he went off to his court hearing. While he was away, the friend that was keeping the radio got into a fight and got thrown into solitary confinement. And so when his friend who was away, who owned the radio, came back, he found out, he was told that the guards had taken the radio, right? Sort of confiscated it. But he found out that what really had happened was his friend had sold the radio because it was worth a lot of money. And so when Petros found out about this, he said, when I found out about this, I got really angry. I went to my friend and told him that when this guy gets out of solitary, he has to go. He has to go. He needs to learn a lesson. And my friend agreed. He said, although my friend is not a violent person, he was concerned about how he would be perceived if he didn't do anything. He too was concerned about his self-image. Later that day, when I sat to meditate, this came to my mind. I was still a little angry, but not as much as when I was talking to my friend. So sitting there, I said to myself, here I am meditating for the purpose of attaining enlightenment. I also recite the Bodhisattva vow every day. Who am I kidding? My ways have not changed at all since I started this practice. I asked myself, what do I really want? Do I really want to end my old views? Do I want to even put some effort into ending my old views? I saw that there was something in me that wanted to let go of the old ways and to understand myself and my life. So this is, he's sort of letting us into that struggle, right? And presenting in very, very, you know, easy to see, right? Wanting to move forward, wanting to transform, practicing, making vows, and yet, in a moment, turns back towards his old habits. And he said, I started to reflect on why I wanted to do something to this guy. Was it because of the radio, which wasn't even mine? Was I concerned about my friend's property? I realized it wasn't about the radio. Bing! Like, this is where the siren should flare. It's like, notice this moment, notice this moment. You just realize it's not about the radio. It's not about the thing out there. There is a thing out there. And we have to deal with that because there's a thing out there. But it's not about the radio. I said, I realized it wasn't about the radio. It was about the principle of being disrespected. We people in prison use the term principle a lot and on the streets. It's not about the radio, it's about the principle, we say. It's not about the money that you owe me, it's about the principle. We do a lot of things over this principle. A lot of guys are in the solitary confinement because of the principle. A lot of guys are in prison because of principle. An idea. Like honor, right? That people for centuries have fought and died and killed over. And it's not that honor isn't important, that what we say and what we do, our integrity, our honesty, how we show up, of course that's important. It's enormously important. When it's a living thing, when it becomes an idea, a projected image, a word, a concept, then what is it? Petros goes on to say, by keeping and selling the radio, was this guy treating my friend like a nobody? Was I hanging out with a nobody? Does that make me a nobody? Is this the reason I feel I have to do something to prove that I'm not a nobody? So it's not about the radio. It's not about, I've got your back, you're my friend. When we trace it back, it comes back. Then he says, this mental conversation went on and on, and it was very disturbing, discovering the true reasons behind the action that I wanted to take. That was depressing. I thought I was sick. I felt hot and cold, back to back. One moment I was sweating, the next moment I was shivering. I thought I had a fever. I started to blame Buddhism. Teachers say if you practice, things will get better. As far as I was concerned, things were getting worse. I wrote a letter to Shugan Sensei at Zen Mountain Monastery and told him that I thought practice things should get better, but they're getting worse. What should I do? That's his goodness that is breaking out all over. That's his heart. If he didn't care, why would he react that way? That reaction was, it was like I thought I was sick. Bingo. We are sick with our delusion. And when we become more and more in contact with it, it shows up more and more. Right? He could not ignore this. How valuable. He said, the lesson I got from all that was seeing what the principle was about. It was my image, not the radio, not my friend, not his image. It was about the image I was trying to protect, the image that I wanted people to see and that was being threatened. And the only way to protect it was through violence. It bothered me that I was concerned more about myself than the situation or my friend. So my challenge is to let go of this strong sense of self. Words and language both arise from our deep patterns, and we perpetuate them. So when we consider the internal dialogue, when we consider right speech, it's not just about moral action, but it's about freeing our mind from this most powerful force that we have access to it every minute of the day and night. And because it's so easy, it's so present, it's so ubiquitous, it's so that it can seem almost valueless, even though we know it has value. It can seem like we know what we're doing when we use it, because we're speaking. And so right speech is not just about moral action, but it's about freeing ourselves from these binding patterns. If we consider mindfulness and concentration and letting go of thoughts, it's not just about calming the mind and developing concentration, but it's about breaking the cycle of samsara as it appears and is created through our language. I mean, just think about it. Think about any moment of contact or experience with something, no matter how simple and benign or how horrific, without language, without any language. What's left? So, of course, without practice, that doesn't happen. What happens is a proliferation of words, and every word means something. And every word is coming, as the Buddha said, from this place of discrimination, from our habit energy, from our karma. And that's why words can have such power. It's like an ongoing influence. It's like somebody who is constantly talking into our ear, trying to convince us of a certain position, a certain view, a certain something. And it just goes on and on. And finally you say, okay. I believe you. But we don't actually remember that moment when we just believed. I mean, we really think about it. It's kind of staggering, right? And it, I think, makes a pretty fair case for Zazen, right? Because it's like, it's not like, okay, I get it. I'm turning it off, right? No more. All right, don't even try that. It's not going to go well. But to actually, okay, practice. And not just calming the mind, because remember the Buddha said, words are neither different nor not different from their reality. The words are not the problem. That's why Dogen said, the entire world of the Ten Directions is the everyday words of a student of the way. And everyone, not just students of the Dharma. But if that's so, why do we react so to them? Why do we react to them like things that we love or hate, that comfort or threaten us, that make us happy? These words. And so somebody says something to you and it makes your day, right? Somebody says something to you and it ruins your day. We fight, we kill, we contemplate violence, we enact violence over words. We always march into war with language, with words, fighting words. Are we really fighting over these noble principles? Everyday means ordinary. Investigate clearly that the entire world of Ten Directions is everyday words. Words are empty of being. Take any word, love, hate, dharma, liberation, anger, child. And can you locate the stuff of that word in that word? The word is a sound. The sound is given meaning. We agree more or less on the meaning of those sounds, and then we use them. But there is altogether more happening in our mind that is creating worlds. Ocean Vuong, the Vietnamese-American poet, said, we often tell people that the future, particularly young students, that the future is in your hands. He said, but I think the future is actually in your mouth. We know language matters, he said. But do we know how we use it? Dogen says, a single fist, just this, is the Ten Directions. A sincere heart, just one, is simply the Ten Directions, crystal clear. Don't say there are two kinds of speech, two kinds of fists, two kinds of hearts, two kinds of minds, two kinds of people. And what I so appreciate about these teachings is that they really demand so much more of us than we very likely would demand of ourselves, I think. They challenge us to examine things on such a deeper level. That passage of Petrus was such an excellent example of examining and taking it further and taking it further. Because we can so easily say, oh, I did it because of this. I get it. But what about this? What's underneath that? And what's underneath that? Which, when we trace it back, what do we find? And how important that is in terms of where do we actually find our distress? Where are we going to find our liberation? What do we actually need to be concentrating on? Right? If he had kept focusing on the radio, there would have been trouble. Realizing it wasn't about the radio liberated him, freed him to direct his attention to where the source was. That's the power of our examination. The Buddha said, the one who goes into a quiet and solitary place and hears the Dharma, reflects and meditates. Dogen says, words are used in an everyday manner. Know that a great person beyond measure turns their body and turns their mind within a phrase. It is the everyday activity of an ocean mouth and a mountain tongue. Thus one covers the mouth and covers the ears. This is the true thusness of the 10 directions. Covering the mouth and covering the ear, so now we can speak and hear freely. Sights, sounds, tastes, textures. We say that all the myriad things return to the one basic, primordial, boundless, you. And arising from this come colors and textures and sounds and sights and symphonies and love ballads and babies smiling and the 10,000 hands. And what all of these masters saw directly and have brought forth is that there's just one direction in the 10 directions. There's one earth, one people, one mind, one delusion, one liberation. Do we see the multitude of worlds being created in every moment through our speech? When we let go of the words and the worlds and everything in one moment, then we see as the 10 directions are inexhaustible, they are the entire 10 directions. So now with your ocean mouth and your mountain tongue, Dogen might say, draw a circle. What is the circle? Go drink tea. When we can see more and more into the real nature of things, we become released more and more, liberated more and more from that sense of being controlled and captured and bound to them, to that, whatever that is. You know, this seems to be more and more urgent as our words are everywhere, everywhere. So, I mean, in essence, wherever we look and see our troublemaking, right there is the very seat of our ability for shift, for change. And this cushion that we're sitting on is the seat of that change. It's the seat of that shift. It happens over and over and over again. And so much of the time, we don't even notice it. These actually profound moments that are happening. Profound. It takes time for us to, in a sense, catch up with the ramification, the depth and breadth of what it is we're actually in the midst of, so that we can use it. So, go have lunch. Go have lunch.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.